Good evening and welcome to the June 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Pride Week is here in the Bay Area, and as it gets underway this week, the annual Pride Parade and Festival is happening next weekend in San Francisco. And this year's definitely a mix of celebration and protest over the very oppressive policies that we're all experiencing coming from Washington, and what feels very much like a direct attack on LGBTQ+ civil rights. Tonight, I'm excited to reintroduce you to a friend and colleague of mine, Finn Dearhart. He'll be joining me on the show regularly to discuss current news and what we can all do to protect our civil rights, freedoms, and our mental health. So stay with us. Finn Dearhart will be with me right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, June 22nd, 2025. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of June 22, 2025. A federal judge has ruled against President Donald Trump's decision to freeze $2.4 billion in National Institutes of Health grant funds allocated to research on gender identity and other fields tied to diversity, equity, and inclusion. The judge said that the Trump administration must immediately restore grants, but he didn't officially rule on whether the Trump's anti-DEI orders are illegal. The case under the judge remains ongoing and could eventually result in an important ruling against the Trump administration's anti-DEI crusade. Judge William Young of the U.S. District Court of the District of Massachusetts said, quote, "This," that's the freezing of the grants, "represents racial discrimination and discrimination against American LGBTQ+ communities." The ruling came as a result of 16 U.S. states and researchers from numerous grantee organizations who sued the Trump administration, accusing it of overseeing an ongoing ideological purge. The suit also said that Trump's January executive order directing all federal agencies to end all government-funded DEI-related initiatives violated constitutional rights of freedom of speech, as well as separation of powers between the president and Congress, since only Congress is legally allowed to change laws regarding budgetary allotments. And in the state of Minnesota, Vance Boltler, a 57-year-old anti-LGBTQ+ evangelical Christian, has been arrested and accused of killing a pro-LGBTQ+ Minnesota State Democratic lawmaker and her husband. He's been arrested and charged with second-degree murder. Boltler, who recently delivered an anti-LGBTQ+ sermon in Africa, allegedly impersonated a police officer before killing the state's now-deceased state House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband, and allegedly shooting State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. Police arrested Boltler on Sunday night following the shooting in the woods of Sibley County using surveillance drones and infrared technology to detect him. They found at least three AK-47 assault rifles, a 9mm handgun, and a hit list of 70 individuals, including Democratic lawmakers and supporters of reproductive choice and other liberal causes. And here in California, members of the Changed Movement gathered on the steps of the California State Capitol and rallied for gay people who want to find Christ and abandon their, quote, LGBTQ lifestyle, unquote. The group of so-called ex-gays is a political successor to the infamous and now disbanded Exodus International Ex-Gay Ministry, which shut its doors back in 2013 when its president admitted that, quote, conversion therapy doesn't work. Now, the same forces behind that failed movement are backing this new organization titled Changed Movement with a repackaged, quote, religious freedom version. The group gathered in Sacramento to celebrate the June 12th anniversary of the failure of the 2018 California bill that would have labeled conversion therapy, quote, fraud. In March, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case challenging state and local laws banning the debunked practice for LGBTQ+ youth, and a decision is expected sometime in 2026. The challenge was filed by Alliance Defending Freedom, which shares ties with Changed Movement, and its primary sponsor, the Mega Bethel Church of Redding, California. The church hosts 11,000 members and has a $60 million annual budget. In 2020, Bethel was the fifth largest employer in Shasta County. Alliance Defending Freedom is wielding unprecedented influence right now in its fight against marriage equality, reproductive rights, gender-affirming care, and other right-wing Christian causes. They're listed as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And here locally, the 55th annual San Francisco Pride Celebration happens next weekend, June 28th and 29th. This year's theme is Queer Joy is Resistance. The festival opens at noon on Saturday in Civic Center Plaza and features multiple performance stages, an 18-plus zone, and a street fair with over 300 artists and exhibitors. The parade starts at 10 a.m. on Market Street at Embarcadero Plaza. The parade typically has over 250 contingents and lasts around 4 hours. Contingents step onto Market Street and proceed toward the parade celebration, ending at around Market and 9th. You can learn more about this year's San Francisco Pride celebration on their website at sfpride.org. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. It's Pride Week here in the Bay Area, and next weekend, the 55th annual San Francisco Pride Celebration will take place Saturday and Sunday, June 28th and 29th. This year's theme is Queer Joy is Resistance. The celebration takes place in San Francisco's Civic Center Plaza and features a main stage and many community spaces and smaller stages, an 18-plus zone, and an LGBTQ+ street fair with over 300 artists and exhibitors. The Pride Parade will take place on Sunday morning starting at 10 a.m. on Market Street at Embarcadero Plaza. The parade typically has over 250 contingents and lasts around 4 hours. Contingents step onto Market Street and proceed toward the Pride celebration, ending at Market and 9th Street. You can learn more at sfpride.org. Well, tonight I'm excited to announce a change in format for this show and to reintroduce you to Finn Dearheart, a friend and colleague who will be joining me regularly for an in-depth discussion of some of the LGBTQ+ news stories happening around the world. Finn is a local activist with a passion for our community and our civil rights, and I'm excited to welcome him to Outbeat News in Depth. Finn, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
Super excited about this and having you on as a regular.
Totally. Yes. I can be regular, I'll try to be regular.
It's just going to be fantastic to have a different format now and as a way to share news with our listeners. And I thought a great way to kind of launch this reformat is to reintroduce you to the show, because you've been on a couple of times before in a different, slightly different capacity. But I want to reintroduce you to our listeners because it's been a few years. I was trying to go back to look and see how many years ago it was. But we've known each other for a while now.
Yeah. I think like 8 years or something.
Yeah. Yeah, at least that. It was definitely before COVID. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting how that's kind of a mile marker in our lives now, before COVID and after COVID?
Yes. I know. Yeah, it actually feels like once COVID and all that started, that it's just been different ever since.
I wonder if we're going to start marking time in a different, what, 3 BC instead of before Christ, before COVID? Is that going to happen?
Yeah, right. I think we should do away with BC. I'd love to do away with before COVID as well.
Come up with something else.
We need to have like a real coming to like a united way of thinking about time and community and the world these days.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. And you know, you grew up in a really religious household. I think that's always been a fascinating part of your story. So let's start there with this reintroduction of you. Tell us about where you grew up and what it was like being in a very conservative religious household as a budding young gay man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so I grew up in the South and all over the South. So my dad is a minister in the Church of Christ, and we traveled around a lot. Like I was in a town maybe 2 or 3 years at a time. At the time it was kind of like normal for me, but looking back I just see that I didn't really ever get the opportunity to make friends and connect, and because the family was like the world that I lived in, like mm-hmm. my family and the church, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were with the church all the time. I was at the church playing during the week, you know, during the summers, because mom would be working and I'd be up there with dad and like playing in the classrooms and playing in the podium and eating stuff in the church kitchen. And then there was like events all the time. So just everything revolved around that. And even when I got a little bit older, I was like, maybe in my 12, 13, 14 years old, I was cleaning the church. They would pay me to clean the church and then to mow the yard. So it was just basically my world revolved around that. And at the time, again, I didn't realize how unique that experience really was until as an adult looking back. Even people who grew up in a religious home, it wasn't like every single moment of their day revolved around the church. We lived in a parsonage that was usually attached to it or n across the yard from it or something like that. And I actually had a moment a couple of days ago just recalling how if I was interested in anything, like inklings about being gay, how much I had to, hide that and just keep it from as far away from my father's purview as possible. And the way that that affected my body, the kind of, and I work with men around this stuff currently in my life, but just the way that our bodies learn how to suppress and compress and contract and like deaden themselves and keep things hidden, and the ways that that plays out in our adult lives once we grow up. Even if we come to somewhere like San Francisco, where we are quote unquote free to do what we want, there's a physical body residue that goes with us. And I'll pause there, but that's just initial dive.
Well, and I can relate a little bit. I mean, I grew up in a very Catholic household and was very involved in catechism and was an altar boy and all of that. But I wasn't immersed in it because I didn't live at the church. I grew up in Moraga, and the chapel early on was at St. Mary's College, which was a very sort of traditional. I mean, I could still smell the inside of that place.
Totally.
And I, at one point I thought about becoming a priest. That was very much a potential vocation for me. And maybe secretly that was a way to hang out with men and to hide. But there was something about that. And you got on a path to become a minister, right?
I did. I'm actually curious to know what you think in revision, looking back about why you didn't, or why you think you might have been interested in that. Was it because of, and there's a reason I'm asking this question in relationship to my own journey, but did you feel like you were trying to contain your own sexuality in some sort of way? Or were you also interested in the spiritual, as a pathway?
I think there was a little bit of that, a little bit of the interest in the spiritual pathway. I think I've always been inherently a teacher. And so there is a teaching, mentoring, coaching, caring aspect of that, similar to law enforcement. I think religion, education, and law enforcement have a lot in common. It may not seem that way on the surface, but there is. Law enforcement and religion, they both have costumes that you wear. They both have uniforms of sorts. But they all care for people, and I think that was part of it. But there was also definitely, I think, the opportunity to have a community surrounded by men that, whether I knew it distinctly at the time or not, was part of it. And it would have been a place to hide.
Well, that's the thing, right? It contains our, I mean, the sexual drive is kind of automatically squared against our egos in the sense that, like, the sexual drive is disruptive in nature and anarchic. And then, like, our egos are all, trying to keep stasis in order. And so there's this internal tension in all of us. And so I think when we choose an environment that automatically creates a contained environment, like in the fundamentalist church, I just personally, I went to college as a freshman at Baylor University, and I was just starting to kind of flirt with the idea in myself of coming out. I was hanging out in cruisy places, and but I couldn't just say it, and I almost felt like I had agoraphobia, like moving away from home, having been in such a compressed environment, and then suddenly I felt so isolated and lonely and kind of scared. Now, this is not something I could have admitted at the time, but looking back, I can just see how lonely and scared I was. And then I went home for the summer between my freshman and sophomore year, and went to church camp as a counselor and m met back up with like all these people from all over, the state of Texas, and was like, "Ah, this is my family. Why did I ever leave?" So I just impulsively decided to drop out of college and go to ministry school. So before sophomore year started, I just, I quit going to Baylor and I jumped into Southwest School of Bible Studies in Texas and in Austin, Texas, and then raised money from local churches to support me there for a couple of years. But I think, like, I really think as I look back about just kind of like the unconscious part of me, yeah, I think I was starting to come up against the edges of how that containment that I had grown up in had been instilled in me and was breaking loose, and it was too scary. And so I just ran back into a place where I felt safe
Sure.
and didn't have to confront any of that. And I continued to live in the closet that way, for many years.
Yeah. Well, as did I. I mean, I entered law enforcement at a pretty early age in high school as a cadet, but the messaging was very clear, probably like the messaging was very clear in your church, that you could not be out. It wouldn't be anything that would be tolerated, and there was no way to be accepted, at that point. And so yeah, you build this wall around you and create maybe these two separate lives. And, I like you was out cruising around different places, but I would never, ever admit that to myself,
Yeah, I could walk away from an experience and it was like just kind of like, okay, now back to life.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually really been that phenomenon repeatedly in my life has been such a place for me of trying to understand other people and a empathy bridge too, because I'm like, well, I know that I lie to myself all the time, and it's not like a switch that you flip when you decide to be truthful. That there's this ongoing psychological experience of just deep splitting. And I, at the time, it was just like, well, oh well. It wasn't like
Yeah.
I was consciously just wanting to, wreck my life or other people's lives again, and got married to a woman. And it was a real conundrum. And so I think that really, when I did come out of the closet, it was such a profound experience for me to
Sure.
look and be like, wow, you can really live in a deception with yourself all the time. And so I think I got really curious about other people's experiences and what they're saying on the surface versus, what might actually be really be happening inside them. And that continues to be my fascination
Nice. Well,
in my work, in my ongoing work.
Well, our past always guide us to our futures, right? And on top of all of that, certainly the messaging you got from the church, you also were a victim of a hate crime that was pretty serious. How did that set you back? And I'm going to make that
Oh,
assumption that it set you back. How did that set you back? Yeah.
it did. It's a very fair assumption. It continues to set me back. And I think it's an interesting question. Don't know how deep we want to get into this right now, but I just, at the time, I was close again. I was kind of flirting with the idea of coming out of the closet. I was in ministry school when that happened. I'd been also hooking up with men and, before chapel and then going to chapel and just that kind of like splitting experience. And I was starting to feel more authentic in the sexual reality that was true for me than I was in the church world. But then I got attacked, and I really, it's a long story, but chased by some guys out in the country. And it went on and on for several hours. I was almost killed, and then I actually just got away. I don't, you weren't wanting me to tell the whole story, or were
Well,
you? I can if you want. It's just like it's kind of a
it's
lengthy story.
it, and it and it's an and it's an awful story, but I guess the reason I ask about it is that it represents sort of that stereotypical thing that we think about in the South and the animus towards gay people.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to sort of talk about it as a stereotype, but you actually experienced it and lived it. These aren't just rumors. People actually are victimized by this hate, and we're still seeing it go on today.
Well, there is a, that's the thing. I'll tell some of the story if we have some
Yeah,
space for it. Do we
of
have time
course.
for it? Yeah, I
Yeah.
think it is actually, because it is coming up for me a lot recently around what's going on today. It's this echo coming back in. So at the time, I and my ministry school best friend, who later became my roommate, we just would get, I had gotten a new car, and we would go driving around listening to music, and I was the new Smashing Pumpkins record, Adore, had come out at the time. It was like a 1999 release. And we went driving out the country. It was one of the ways that we could connect and be in a space with each other, I think, that felt kind of liminal and available in ways that weren't mediated by, church and the roles that we played. It's almost like being in the car at night, driving around. We had more freedom. And we drove out into the country, outside of Austin proper and pulled over on the side of the road because it was raining pretty heavily. It was a thunderstorm was happening. So we parked on the side of the road in a some this random it's Bear Creek Pass, which now is like a subdivision out. It's been really heavily developed, but at the time there was nothing out there.
Right.
And I was sitting on the side of the road. We kept the heater running, and we're just listening to music and talking. And out of nowhere, like it's this truck drove up. It was a F-150. They drove up and they pulled in front of my car, facing us directly and shining the lights directly into the window. And I thought it felt aggressive already, you know. So I felt really scared, and I made sure I locked the door, checked it a few times, and somebody got out of the passenger side of that truck. He had a shaved head. He had took his shirt off and like walked up to the car window, and I guess I can't on the radio say all the things he was saying, but like was using slurs and was saying, "Get out of the car, you're gonna die." He kept saying that, "You're gonna die." And I'd been in this situation before, you know, as like a high schooler being bullied, and I couldn't tell, like, is this just, are they just bullying us? Is this something that they're trying to scare me? At the time, I was still trying to make sense of it. It just felt very shocking. So I backed up my car and pulled around them and went straight down this road. And I didn't know where this road was going. I'd never been on this road. It's way out in the country. And the truck started chasing us. And then we started speeding up, and they were chasing us harder. And this was like a real small road. It was raining, we're skidding. It was this really dangerous feeling, and I started feeling like, yeah, this is, I don't think they're just bullying us. I think this is more real, and I'm still trying to come to terms with that. I was driving, and I came to a stop sign multiple times, and it dawned on me that I'd been at this stop sign already several times. I've been going in circles, and I had this horror feeling of like, I feel like I'm in a maze. So I turned at this stop sign in a different direction, and it went up a really long hill, and I couldn't see the top of the hill. And when I got to the top of the hill, it was a cul-de-sac. And so I turned the car around and just faced the entrance of the cul-de-sac and turned off the headlights and just sat there for a second and was, you know, like, what do we do? I'm trying not to cuss on here. Like, what do we do? And so I was really freaking out. And my roommate, whom I will call Greg at the time, that's not his real name, but oh, wait, you're Greg. So I can't,
Yeah,
like,
that's okay.
So my spirit friend, Greg, was there. And he was like, you know what? Let me drive. You're not so good under stress right now. And he was super stoic and cool at the moment. And I was really freaking out. And I remember that I had brought my cell phone, which this is back when cell phones were like as big as a book, you know? And I had charged it up before I left the house that night on a kind of a whim. Like I was like, oh, I don't want to take my phone. I was like, you know what? I'll charge it up and take it just in case. And I'd had this whole dialogue in my head about it and decided deliberately to do so. And so I was so glad that I had the cell phone in the car. I pulled it out and I dialed 911. And when the dispatcher came on, you know, she was asking us like, "Where are you? What?" And I had no idea. I could not tell her landmarks. I couldn't tell her anything about where I'd been. I just knew like 20 minutes back, I was on this highway, you know, 1826. That's all I knew. So she just convinced me to stay on the line with her. Well, about that time, the assailant was walking up the hill, and I should be clear, there were two of them. One person was getting out of the passenger side, and one person was driving the truck. So the shaved head guy was walking up the hill, and I saw his crown coming over the edge of the cul-de-sac. And he walked up to the side of the car and started the same stuff, and was just like yelling, using slurs, and saying that we were going to die, and started punching the window really hard. And he was punching it so hard, I actually was like, I can't believe it's not breaking in on his hand. And then I was then like, who punches their hand through a glass without being, you know, like a super predator, or is he on drugs? You know, essentially he was, and I found that out later. But he walked into the bushes and came back with a football sized rock. And my friend, who is driving now, gassed the car forward, and the rock hit on the trim of the window above the driver's side and glanced off, so it didn't hit anything that was broke. So I was freaking out, yelling at the phone. It was like a big drama. And then the man walked off in the bushes and got another rock. And so my friend pulled our car into this driveway in this cul-de-sac with a where a house was being built. It was like a construction site, and it was the only thing in the cul-de-sac was this home that was being built. It was like still like in that phase of a house skeleton, where some of it was put together, and there were like those little orange flags, like in the driveway. So it was pretty clear like no one was there, but there's this hope that maybe someone's in there, because it looked like there was some part of the house was livable, and there was a car parked there. So we were honking on the horn, and nothing, like there's no one in this house. About that time, down the hill, we could see down the hill, and since our car lights weren't on, we could see the lights coming up the hill, but the person who was driving that truck could not see us. And so I'm sitting here on the phone with the dispatcher, and I was asking her, should I get out of the car and run into the woods? And she was like, no, the car is like the only thing you have is your defense. And I had just been through like, well, the rocks are hitting the car. This is not a defense. And I was freaking out, and then started to think like, I'm gonna die right now. I really should hang up the phone on her and call my mom and just say, I talked to my mom. And that was a bizarre moment for me. Kind of felt like I was sinking in water or something, and really super dissociating. And had all these violent images in my head of what was about to happen to me. But the dispatcher was like, no, stay here, stay here, stay here. So while this was happening, the truck drove by and didn't see us in the driveway. And so my friend just reversed it and gassed really hard. And we went into a ditch behind this house,
Oh, geez.
like skidding in the ditch. Yeah, and the man on the foot was like running up to the car and was like yelling, and the truck was making this big wide sweep trying to turn back around. And our car caught the pavement and got on the road. So we're like, we got away, and we like were jubilant prematurely, because we went back through that little maze of country roads, and we got back out to the main entrance of the highway, where we would have got back into Austin within about 10 minutes or so. And this truck had already, and I've still not known how this happened. I've tried to figure this out, and it's useless, but the truck had beat us there. And both men were standing now. The truck was parked sideways in the bottom of, in the entrance of the highway, and they both had rocks, like really big rocks. So we parked for a second in the middle of the road. It was this a standoff, and just I was like, run over them, run over them, run over them. Like, you trying to get my friend to just run right into them, which is a really interesting moment for me. And the dispatcher was like, no, you can't do that. That might make it more complicated for you. I didn't really understand the logic at the time, because I felt like it was clearly self-defense, but she was saying, no, don't do it. So my friend just basically slammed on the gas and was racing toward them, like kind of like in a game of chicken, and they didn't move. They were not going to move. And so he went around them through a ditch and just skid around, and stayed on the road, managed to keep a little bit of himself on the road. And we got back onto the main highway. And so we were again like, yay, we got away. And while, but oh, I should say, but before we got on the highway, they threw these rocks at the car. And they both hit the windshield, and it didn't, since it was a sideways hit, it didn't come into the car, but it did shatter the windshield.
No,
So,
cheese.
yeah, so we were driving back into Austin. We, Nathan, I almost said his name. He was looking outside. He was looking outside of the car, like outside of his driver's side window, so he could see
Right.
better to drive. And then we see like the trucks. Headlights were in the rearview mirror and following us again. They came up on our bumper. They were trying to get us to swerve off the road. They were trying to get around. So my friend was driving in the middle of both lanes to try to hog all the lanes. I had arranged a deal with the dispatcher to have police on the scene at a gas station, at this big Tiger Mart at the corner of these two major roads that we were close to. And we were driving toward that, them on our tail the whole way. As soon as we started coming back into the city, there are other people out on the road at this point. This truck drove around us and pulled in front of us in the middle of traffic and pulled sideways in the road and blocked traffic. And so I was just like, it was kind of like watching a movie. I was dissociated a lot anyway because of the trauma happening, but at the same time, I just kept thinking every step of the way, like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, they're really, it was like a Terminator movie, you
Very
know?
determined.
Yeah, they parked sideways, and so then they were like blocking cars. There were a number of cars out, and so my friend pulled into oncoming traffic and was driving the wrong way down the road just to get around them. And there were medians, so there was only access to get back into our side of the road every, you know, half block or so because of the medians. So we did that for a second. People were flashing their lights at us and, like, you know, trying to get us to what they had no idea. And we finally get back into our lane, and the cops were not where they said they were going to be. Like, we pulled up to the intersection where that Tiger Mart was, and my heart sank because there was no one there. And we were, we're. I'm almost done with this story, by the way. But we thought, okay, we'll just drive to the police station, and we'll just have them tail us all the way there. And you know, so we pulled onto this road that was headed towards the police station, and the dispatcher was saying, "No, you go back. They're going to be there. And if you change positions, it's going to be harder. Just go back to where either they're on the scene right now or they're about to be there." So the truck was still behind us, and we pulled big U in the road and headed back towards this gas station where the cops were now there. And the truck was right beside us. We were in the inside lane, headed down this road, next to the dash line, you know. And they were in the outer lane, the right-hand side, and the driver was not looking in front of him, and they were yelling out the window. They were saying that we're gonna die still. It was like this thing. They just kept going and going and going, and they weren't paying attention. And there was a small car in front of them that was pulling off and gonna take a right-hand turn into a residential. And they plowed right into the back of that car, like going as fast as we were going. I think probably like around 50 something miles an hour. And I'm looking outside of the passenger side window and just saw it all happening. Like, it just
Oh,
kind of like,
jeez.
whoa, yeah. So then we drove up to the gas station and parked for a second, you know, and it was just like that's we kind of caught up with what it was happening. And I got out of the car and we were shaking. And a police officer came up to us and asked us to come back to the scene, do some questioning, and that's kind of where the night, yeah, concluded. But the truck had hit that car and severely injured a passenger in that car. There was like a helicopter that came that airlifted them to a hospital. Yeah, it was really, really intense. I mean, I'm kind of telling it with a little less affect right now because it's again like a long story, and I could definitely give tons more details, which I have written about. There's places for people to go read more about that if they want to, but
Well, yeah, we definitely want to provide that
pause.
for people to follow up on, for sure.
You know, the thing that when they put me, then they separated my friend and me into separate cop cars to make sure that our stories were lining up, and I understand the logic in that. And they kept asking, like, "Were you doing drugs? Were you guys having sex?" And I just, at that time, it was like I couldn't. It was like I was scared that of my own gayness, you know, that I knew that those guys thought that I was gay, or they could see that I was gay. They targeted me for this reason, but I wasn't out, and I wasn't, like, you know, letting myself have that permission and that truth. And so a police officer, she was saying, you know, "Well, it was it do they call you a fag? Do they what, you know?" And they kept, I felt like they were trying to get me just to kind of admit something around there. That was the way I was perceiving it at the time, and I just couldn't do it. And I was like, no. I just wouldn't, you know. And she said, "Well, if it's a hate crime, if it was a hate crime, that means that they'd be in more trouble." And I was like, "No, yeah, no." They was trying to just like squelch the conversation. And it was almost like, I've written about this, it was almost like her saying that would have kind of forced me out of the closet. And so I wouldn't go there. I was like, yeah, I don't know.
I think sometimes too, those questions probably make you feel like somehow that would justify their actions. Oh, that would explain why they were doing it. Oh, well, now this makes sense.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I wasn't ready to have that conversation with me or anybody. So those men did end up getting prosecuted. They went to prison, assault with a deadly weapon. And I got some money for my car because they, you know, bashed up the car. But it really did, in answer to your other contextual question, I definitely would not come out of the closet at that point. And it, like, shortly thereafter, I started dating a woman that I got married to.
Yeah. That's not an uncommon situation, right? I mean, the hate crime is uncommon. But what draws people to sort of go into a relationship in order to conform and to fit into the rest of what society expects, quote unquote, that's happened a lot.
Yeah, and I think the echoes of that are present in the current times, you know, like with the resistance movement, and even like last year I went to the trans march, and it felt like I was really confronting something deep in myself to go into a public space like that.
Mm-hmm.
I often fear being in big crowds. It's not like a panic attack situation. I'm pretty regulated emotionally around these things, but I definitely avoid large crowds. And I pushed myself to do it because I felt like, well, I want to put at least my body on the line with my privilege, you know, to really help show up. And that's an ongoing theme. And it feels like this administration is like a continuation of some of those experiences I had when I was younger that I felt like, and illusorily so, and maybe mm-hmm. as a function of my privilege as a white cis man, I thought, oh, that's all behind me now, you know, which it's not behind me, and it never has been, and it hasn't been behind many, many, many people's lives. You know, they're in this constantly. So it's just something I'm working with presently, and also trying to extend that invitation to other cis men and people that are white to really understand what their privilege is insulating them against. And so to help create this empathetic bridge to join where people really need us, you know, so, yeah.
It all led you to your work. And your dad is still an active minister, right?
Yeah. Yes. He and I don't talk. I should like really declare that. We don't talk, but I do have like a lot of conversations in my head with him.
Because he's, and you've shared this with me already, he's very outspokenly anti-gay.
He is. He supports, like, he wants it to be criminalized. He supports the Ugandan government's decision to uphold the death penalty for same-sex sodomy, I guess, is the... he is really racist. You know, there was a period of time where I was listening to his... He has a podcast, and I would listen to it so that I could engage with the feelings that were coming up in me. And it just felt almost like a repetitious kind of thing. Like I couldn't help it. Like I just really wanted to listen to this. And I would always get like really upset. And my therapist and even some of my friends would be like, why do you listen to that? I'm like, well, I was working through a process around like the guilt that I feel about cutting him out of my life because he's not coming to repair. And, but also just as a kind of like arm myself in a way where like if I do have a confrontation with him at some point, and I think he typifies people for me in my mind too as my father, but also like the father and the government and the mm-hmm. all the people that are in like in bed with that whole movement, to really know and hear what he's saying and the place in him that it comes from. And since I do counseling work with men anyway, I'm often in a situation where I listen to men, and since I don't have that tie in personal, you know, history, I can listen to their rage or their anger in a way that's like, I'm very curious about it and I'm not personalizing it. And I'm actually able to hear layers deep inside of that for them, what, and try to help create like a possibility where that conversation can move. Mm-hmm. So I was listening to my dad talk in his rants in the same way. And that was healing for me to be like, oh, you feel really hurt and angry and invisible, and you know, and just to kind of be listen to it like with a curiosity and to try to hear some of the undertones.
Do you think he resembles at all Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church sort of mentality?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that extreme?
Oh, yeah, yeah, and he's not out like you know, with signs and you know, but he definitely is stoking and galvanizing around the quote. He talks about the quote unquote transgender insanity. He uses that phrase. He's very racist and talks openly about a moral depravity, quote unquote, in black people, and we'll quote statistics around teen pregnancy and stuff. It's ridiculous, which I personally am. I was born before they were married. I was a wedlock baby. So I'm like, I want to throw my phone across the room and listening to this person. And also, I've really gotten into the work of Jeff Charlotte. He's a historian and writing teacher at Dartmouth. And his book, The Undertow, has been really like a light bulb for me around the grief carried by this constituency of white people that are really, carrying a lot of pain and anger and have attached onto this MAGA movement as a way to rescue them from their own existential feelings of worthlessness. But they have this kind of grief story that's floating because it's not anchored into a reality that's collective. It's very isolated, right? It's like, yes, of course you have these pains. Yes, of course you. And this is like a thing that I come up against with when in whiteness, which is like, well, I hurt too. It's like, yeah, yes. And it's a kind of like this like floating grief because it doesn't even know where to attach. Like your own personal experiences, they don't have a way to see themselves as contextualized in the world. It's a really, really, really narcissistic position because in Charlotte's work, actually, I love all the land acknowledgments he makes with the different indigenous peoples that were on the land. The way he constructed that narrative in the book is that he would share the indigenous thread underneath, but the focal point of the material was on the grief or the loss that the people were feeling, like like maybe the white evangelicals and their lamentations, but the way that it comes across when you read it is like, wow, they're so disconnected from the reality and what to do with that grief, so it ends up metastasizing and turning into this engine of like hatred, versus like this possibility to be connected and feel empathy and to feel rage about what's happening to the world, to all of us. It just really is just bizarre.
So tell us about what you're doing today. I mean, all of this has fed into and has shaped your passion for the work that you're doing today. So tell our listeners a little bit about what you're doing and the work that you do. You're in San Francisco now. You spent some time after we first met, you moved up to Nevada City, which, I have my own stereotypes about what that was like, but you found it as a pretty cool place, but now you've moved back to San Francisco. What are you doing today?
Yeah, I am back in San Francisco and I love being back here. The Nevada City was really a sweet place to be to ride out COVID. Also, the river and the trees and the stars, it's all very beautiful and magical and lush. And I felt lonely and just missed being around diversity and being around a more urgent conversation in all the things. And certainly in the Bay Area, it feels urgent. So, like, here I am, and I work with mostly gay men, like queer men, some trans men, in sexuality and relationships. And that's been my work for the last 8 years or so. And I'm kind of shifting over, not kind of, I am shifting over more into writing and social justice and just seeing the connection there too, that sexuality is very much connected to that conversation anyway. But I think my work is shifting, and I just don't know where it's headed exactly. I'm kind of taking a trusting kind of, I guess, faith walk, to employ those terms again.
Well, one of the directions it's heading is on this show, talking about social justice and the news. And what I like to say is activism through education. I think that is a very, very powerful form of activism. And it's certainly the form of activism I feel most comfortable in. I'm not a person who's going to chain themselves to an oak tree, or lay down in the middle of a road or get arrested. But I do think that information is power. And so that's really, I think, at the heart of what I see this show is as being a value too. It's informing people, and so hopefully we're going to get to do that
Absolutely. That's what I'm hoping for.
at least once a month here. Let's take a quick music break. You picked out a song for us that I think is apropos. What is it?
Yes. Son of a Preacher Man.
All right, and we'll be yes. right and we'll be right back. Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield. So we've got time to talk about one news story, and I thought it might be interesting to look at one that sort of hits to the question about where does all of this hatred, the type of hatred that you experienced, and a lot of the homophobia and transphobia in our society come from? I mean, there are people who are just passionately homophobic.
Yeah.
And it just seems almost odd they have so much passion around it. But this is a story that was published on June 12th. And this is about a person that the Moms for Liberty group, which is a very anti-LGBT group, they've been advocating to get rid of LGBTQ-themed books in schools because they assert that those books groom children and that they spread pornography. So this South Carolina representative, R.J. Mm-hmm. May, who was honored as the Moms for Liberty Legislator of the Year in 2023, was just arrested by federal authorities for possessing and distributing child pornography. Some of the details that he is accused of doing is possessing and exchanging 220 different images of toddlers and young children involved in sexual acts. And the article, you know, specifies that he is married and has children of this same age. Federal authorities believe that he has a sexual interest in incest between young children and their parents based upon these images. Mm. I see this and go, well, gosh, it's so clear. That's where this homophobia and transphobia comes from.
Yeah.
I mean, when you hear stories like that, what are you thinking?
Well, okay, I feel like it's obvious. I feel like every time we see this, there's so many cases of people who are vitriolic against anything around the sexual, and I'm using it in a general sense, and that it's because they're having this war inside themselves about it. You know, it's so, these are your images, like all this like fear of grooming children. I'm like, oh, so you think about sexuality and children being in the same, you know, psychic sphere. That's why you're so concerned about it out in the world. And it's like, when do we see people who are working to try to help in the sexuality world, it's very rare that we see it in the same way where like a Republican legislator or something ends up in a bathroom somewhere, you know, getting caught. It's like a trope.
I
what
mean,
about you?
I think the same kinds of things I feel and see when I think about all the sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And of course, that's an organization that has some closeness to my own heart because that's where I grew up in it. But the hypocrisy, right? The hate and the vitriol that I hear directed at me by leaders of the Catholic Church, the same organization that covered up thousands and thousands of child abuse cases.
Yeah.
Where there are so many gay men that have been living a closeted life for many, 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 let's just call it centuries.
Yeah.
It's angering. It's frustrating. Well,
it is. And I mean, like, I think it's like such a wider context that really is at stake, because everybody, our sexual drive, it's polymorphously perverse. Like being a human and being a civilized being is like a construction of our egos and like our social connections versus what lives inside the human drive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we have the extremes and the fringes of experience are all inside of us. And so the sadism, the violence that we see in the world, we contain all of that, right? And so people who, like, we're all doing some level of repressing to what lives inside of us, and you know, for good reason. But there's a large portion of people who that's kind of breaking through in some sort of way, and they're projecting it outward, you know, and so they're seeing out in the world what they're wrestling with. And it's not always one to one. It's not like, oh, I see this in the world, therefore that's what I'm actually wrestling with, in, you know, personally. But it is connected to this energy that's inside in the unconscious. And so I don't know, like, it, whenever someone's like obsessed with a very specific facet, like, you know, kind of like my father, or, you know, it's like, well, how, it's, you're the one thinking about men having sex all the time, or you're the one thinking about children being at risk. Like, that must touch something in you,
right?
Whether it's a personal experience in your life that you're trying to wrestle with, you know, that, like, a lot of these people might have been violated as children themselves, and so, but they've never done any kind of work around that, you know. So, or they might actually be minor attracted and are doing a lot to try to push that down.
And it makes me wonder if there's some similarity between the anti-trans sentiment, and maybe it's just a discomfort with understanding what gender is. I have to believe there's part of that, but boy, I sure hope you and I get to explore that more, because the level of animus towards trans folks right now is just, it's almost unexplainable to me.
I do have a theory, but I know we don't have time to really dig fully into that. I'd love to talk about that more, but maybe it's just kind of a way to think about this going forward in the next month. It's like, if our understanding about gender goes and gets revised, because culture is really founded on some of these bedrock assumptions, and I think humans in general are going through a massive evolution on the planet. The more we're overpopulated, the more we're dealing with like global crises. Gender is one of the deeper substrata of how culture, society, stability, quote unquote, is organized in the psyche, but also in the world, and how we create these cultures. And I think that trans bodies are the site, the visible site at which that warfare is being waged, because there's this like incredible repressive energy to try to keep it from changing and shifting. But if trans people, they show in real time, we can really, I'd love to get into the understanding about gender, the fluidity of that, and the possibility that we could change so much more, actually.
Well, let's put that on our docket for sure.
Yeah.
So where can people go to learn more about you and link up and follow all the writing and work you're doing?
Well, findearheart.com, findearheart.com is a good place to start for my professional work, and also my Substack. It's called Getting to Naked, and that's findearheart.substack.com. And that's where I write more personally about sex, sexuality, gender, politics,
Perfect. We'll put links on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page. We'll have those links regularly featured so that you can follow Finn's work and our conversation moving forward. Super excited about this evolution, Finn, and I cannot wait to get to our next set of news stories and time. Are you going to San Francisco Pride?
I am still sitting with how much of it I want to go to. I do want to make some sort of appearance and some solidarity. I just don't know what and where. And sometimes the massive gathering down by the Civic Center is just too much for me. Well, I do want to be involved somewhere.
And we'll see where it all goes with all of the anti-immigration protests. I think it's going to look very different than it has in the past.
Totally.
So enjoy the week, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, you too. Big hug.
And don't forget, the San Francisco Pride Celebration happens next Saturday and Sunday, starting with the festival opening at 12 noon at Civic Center Plaza. And then the parade happens on Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on Market Street. You can get details about the entertainers and all of the events happening at San Francisco Pride on their website at sfpride.org. And that wraps up our hour. Tune in next Sunday night for an Outbeat Extra with Del Phoenix. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week. Happy Pride. And thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to. So I give it up to you. You're broken down and tired of living life on a merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter. But I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains. We gon' walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise up, I'll rise like the day. I'll rise up, I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I a thousand times again. And I'll rise up, I like the waves. I'll rise up in spite of the ache. I'll rise up, and I'll do it a thousand times again. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Rohnert Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.